Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I'm very excited about tonight's event. Years ago, I read Dr. Doig's previous book, The Brain That Changes Itself, and the last couple weeks I've spent really enjoying the new book. There's so many different ways that I keep thinking about all the ways that neuroplasticity and what we learn and how we can learn to direct it using new techniques or very, very old techniques, at least in terms of human terms. How can that perhaps contribute to our lives in so many ways in the lives of those around us? Please join me in welcoming Dr. Doig.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be at this bookstore. It's one of my favorite bookstores that I've got lost in over the years. It's really just a national treasure, and you're lucky to have it locally. For about 100 years, the words brain and healing were not used in the same sentence by neuroscientists and clinicians. There were practical and theoretical reasons for that. Practically, there's this notoriously poor prognosis for many brain problems. These are personal catastrophes. And in fact, by entitling my book, The Brain's Way of Healing, I won't deny that I've been a little bit nervous about it. Because it's so going against the grain of my training and what's been widely accepted. And, you know, who am I to basically argue that an organ which many, many people have found has a very grim prognosis when damaged? Who am I to make a claim to the contrary? And am I raising false expectations? I carry that as a burden every day. But I also carry as a burden the thought that I have seen a number of people get better in ways that don't make sense in the existing paradigm. And although not everybody gets better or will get better from reading this book, I've had to basically do an assessment as to whether it's best to be timid and not make any claims that the brain can heal, for fear of rousing hopes in those who might not be helped. I have to weigh that against the fact that there are some people that I fervently believe can be helped by these new discoveries. And so the book is called The Brain's Way of Healing. The theoretical reasons that the brain has thought to be something that doesn't heal have been multiple. And in general, the theory has been that the brain, in the course of evolution, became so specialized, so complex, that a price was paid. That unlike other organs, the skin, the liver, the bones, there was no recourse to replacement parts. There was nothing much that could be done. The brain was just so sophisticated that even if replacement parts were to be found, how might they fit into the existing circuitry of the brain? Well, it turns out, I will argue, that the brain is not too sophisticated for its own good after all, and that the very attributes that make it so sophisticated, its ability to form circuitry, and as we discover with neuroplasticity, unform it and then reform it, makes possible a unique kind of healing, which I call the brain's way of healing. I have another problem in terms of communicating this message. I understand that what I'm going to describe to many will sound too good to be true in certain respects, flaky to some people. This book turned out to focus a lot on energy. And, you know, energy is something that people talk about in many new wave kinds of interventions in ways that are very difficult to define. Nonetheless, the energy that I'm going to be talking about in this book is all definable according to Western neuroscience and Western physics. I ended up traveling five continents to put together the material in this book. And in my travels, I saw the following things that I will forgive you all for doubting. I saw examples of sounds played into the ear to lead to radical improvements in autism, sensory processing disorder, traumatic brain injury. The last two, actually, I saw done. I saw patients who had that done here in Denver, Colorado, by some people in the audience today, Drs. Ron Minson, Kate Minson, Randall Redfield from ILS, just a remarkable national treasure that has grown up here in Denver, Colorado. I've seen cases of vibration on the back of the head cure attention deficit disorder. I've seen cases of gentle electrical stimulation to turn on touch receptors on the tongue, not to shock the brain, just to turn on the touch receptors, which led to significant diminishment of symptoms of multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, and stroke. I've seen instances of light shone on the back of the neck, originally for a neck problem in a man who had a stroke and lost his visual span, and who found that his visual span widened. I've subsequently seen the use of light on the back of the neck to treat a serious brain injury, seen it in the nose, shone in the nose, to successfully help sleep. I have even met with a surgeon who himself was saved from a gastrointestinal bleed by having a laser light, a low-intensity laser light, shone into his stomach instead of having invasive surgery that healed it, and who subsequently went on to use light intravenously to save or protect his patients from sepsis, which is widespread infection. Imagine that as a new kind of treatment, using sticking light up an intravenous instead of an antibiotic. And his patient, who was on death's door, recovered. The antibiotics that did not work for him began to work. I've seen examples of hands held by an expert on the cranium that have improved epilepsy. The use of visualization for chronic pain of many years' duration that was unresponsive to all known conventional and unconventional treatments lead to a complete remission of that chronic pain. I've seen the slow, soft movements of the human hand over the body to cure a girl born missing a huge section of her brain of cognitive problems and near paralysis. And in the book, I show that all of these techniques stimulate, sometimes for the first time, at other times reawaken, dormant brain circuitry. If this all sounds too good to be true, I'd like to unpack the reasons for our reluctance to find it credible. And the first one is something that I think afflicts all of medicine in modern times to some degree or another. Modern medicine began with modern science. Modern science was very different in its conception and its goals than ancient science. Ancient science, you know, with people like Aristotle, etc., was seen as the fulfillment of essential human capacities. Human beings were seized by wonder, and wondering about the universe, how it works, was understood to be a natural human activity in and of itself. Simple as that. So science was not fundamentally instrumental. It's not that the Greeks were not cunning and they didn't invent levers and things like that. But their overall conception of science was understanding. With the rise of modern science, science was conceived of as the conquest of nature. A lot of this came from Machiavelli's ideas. Machiavelli actually worked with Leonardo da Vinci on an early project to divert the Arno River. one of the first attempts at the conquest of nature. And shortly after that, the great theorist of experimentation, Sir Francis Bacon, started to describe experiments as torturing nature for her secrets, and science was conceived as the conquest of nature for the relief of man's estate. And modern medicine was part of the relief of man's estate, so that one of the first great modern physicians, Thomas Sydenham, who's described as the English Hippocrates, talked about how there is a murderous array of diseases that arises up against the physician, and the physician has to basically outmaneuver them, conquer them, kill them. This was the language of medicine for a long time. It is the language of medicine today. On my airplane ride out through the States, I open up a book of airline travel and I see a hospital advertising, you know, help us combat heart disease. We have a war against AIDS. We want to defeat Alzheimer's. The military metaphor is everywhere. The first drugs that were developed in modern times were called magic bullets. And so we have this notion that treatment is a kind of weaponry. And as is the case with weaponry, there's always an arms race, and you want the higher tech weaponry. That's what you think is going to make the big difference. And it tends to be invasive, another military metaphor. Now, I'm not saying that there is no role for a military metaphor in medicine. This is not a peacenik talking. I'm not anti-military. There is a time for the military metaphor in medicine. If you burst a blood vessel in your brain, you want a neurosurgeon with martial virtue, decisiveness, not a squeamish person who can crack open your skull and get in there and stop the bleeding. That's important. Emergency medicine, to some, in many respects, requires martial virtue, and it grew out of battlefield medicine, where you don't always have to do randomized control trials when someone is showing up with their guts falling out. You do what you have to do. So this is not a dogmatic concern of mine. This is just an attempted analysis. But the military metaphor has impacted how doctors often see themselves, how we conduct ourselves, and how patients see themselves. You know, we call our bag of tricks the therapeutic armamentarium. And when we deal with patients, what we find is, and what the patient finds, is that the confrontation is usually the confrontation that will decide his or her fate is between the doctor and the disease. And the patient finds that his body, and maybe even his or her soul, is merely the battlefield upon which this great confrontation occurs, and feels very passive and left out of these very, very important encounters. It even, and I say this not excluding myself, affects how we as physicians sometimes talk to our patients. We often interrupt them because for the high-tech physician, what really matters is not so much the patient's narrative as their lab test. And so the military metaphor has caused us to really think that if a treatment is not highly invasive and not high tech, that it couldn't possibly be serious. And these treatments I'm going to describe are all non-invasive. And there is some technical know-how to all of them, but no one would call them extremely high tech. Now, there have been many problems with our model of the brain. By the way, I think we can just, you know, I think we're just going to have to look at this as though we're colorblind. We're going to have some very unusual colors attached to these films. There are many problems with our models of the brain. They are, after all, models. The first book dealt with the idea that the brain was fixed and hardwired, and it challenged that. We basically thought that the circuitry of the brain was formed and finalized in childhood. We had a machine metaphor for the brain, and this goes all the way back to René Descartes. In many ways, the first neuroscientist who proposed were divided into two substances. One of them is a mental substance, res cogitans, he called it, and it works by its own laws. And then the other substance is a physical substance, res extensa, and that was the human brain. And it worked according to the mechanical laws of the new physics that had been developed by Galileo. At the time, the whole world was seen as functioning mechanically by Galileo. The world was seen literally as a cosmic clock, and the planets, which the ancients saw as anthropomorphized, like Mars and Venus and Jupiter, they attributed human qualities to them, were seen as matter in motion. And what governed that motion were the laws of the new physics, which were mechanical laws. So Descartes had a very mechanical view of the brain. It was a hydraulic model of the brain, but there was something to it. He conceived of circuits. The nerves were kind of had currents flowing in them to the brain, and they were reflected back. That's where we get the idea of reflex. And there was kind of something to that. It seemed, though, that the brain has been so complex that we've always thirsted for metaphors for it. And in the industrialized age, the metaphor has almost always been a machine. And the machine metaphor changed as the most impressive machines around us changed, and it soon became an electrical machine. And that's why we still today speak of the brain as having circuits. Actually, there are no wires in the brain. It's a metaphor. It's a pretty good metaphor, but it's a metaphor. And so it went from being an electrical machine in the late 1800s, early 1900s, to mid-last century becoming a computer. It went from having hardwired circuits, which people still speak of, to having hardware. And there are schools within neuroscience that are called computationalists that are quite insistent, even today, that the brain is best conceived of as a biological computer. Now, these are metaphors, and they reveal certain things about the brain's workings, but they also conceal much. This book begins where the last book left off. At the end of having finished the last book, I had many, many people contacting me with different kinds of stories, like the stories in the book. People who had made recoveries that weren't supposed to happen. And I think they felt very validated in the book, because so often they would go to their physicians and describe their recoveries. And, you know, the physicians are very rushed, and I totally get that. We physicians are caught in a terrible system that's very dehumanizing and, you know, forcing us to see patients for 10 or 15 minutes. Not psychiatrists, although increasingly so, psychiatrists too. And someone would come in and say, I had Parkinson's and I was able to get over this symptom or that system. They'd tell their physician and they kind of nod, but they wouldn't really ask them, how did you do that? Because the clock was running. And sometimes they just disbelieved it. They checked to see if the original diagnosis was wrong, or they thought that the patient was flaky. You know, but so often the case was they denied the cure, the practical improvement that was right in front of them, because theoretically they knew it was not possible because the brain is fixed. And they was on to the next patient. So some of those people reached out to me. And in general, what I tried to do was evaluate whether there was something in this that was new or just something I'd already described in the first book. And if it was something that was new that I did not understand, that was a criterion. I sought them out. I sought their doctors out. I tried to make sure the diagnosis was initially correct and so on. And then I tried to reverse engineer what might be going on in those people. And I started over time to notice a number of patterns. I started to spend a lot of time with what I would call the second generation of neuroplasticians. That's a term I developed for these people. Some people find it awkward as a term, but it's okay for me. And what I noticed is a lot of them were doing treatments that involved energy in one way. They were using energy in one way or another to try to influence the brain circuitry. And as you'll see if you read this book, I believe that this use of energy to influence circuitry in combination with mental exercises of various kinds will actually provide a bridge between Western neuroscience and Eastern medicine. Western neuroscience has known a lot about the brain, a lot about the details, the fine details about the brain, but not a lot about how to use energy clinically. It's almost funny, you know? And sometimes when there are people who are pretty skeptical of the use of energy, who are, let's say, Western physicians, they say things to me like, well, do you have a brain scan for that? Can you show that with a brain scan? And I say to them, well, you wouldn't want to look at that. And they say, why? And I say, because brain scans are all about energy. Every brain x-rays, that's energy. They're not showing something material. They think the brain scans are material, but x-rays are about energy. And fMRIs are about magnetic energy. And those that use radiation, they're about, you know, different kinds of radiation are about energy. It's so funny. In clinical medicine, doctors are very uncomfortable about talking about energy-based interventions for the most part. There are a few exceptions. The use of hot lasers to destroy tissue, that's okay. ECT, that's understood. And there are a few energy treatments. But in general, you know, it's medication and surgery. And yet, if you look at the investigations, they're all based on energy. They're based on laser physics. They're based on the latest developments in energy. But clinically, we're kind of in the Newtonian world, funnily enough. And what is the most common clinical symptom? Fatigue. That's an energy symptom. Absence of energy. So I think that there's this whole blind spot about energy. In this book, I take on what I think are some of the limits of how we look at the brain. And it was only at the end of the book that I put together all the ideas in the book after writing it. And I came up with the sentence. We just have a few problems with our current view of the brain. It's too material, it's too chemical, it's too digital, it's too imperial, it's too cortical, it's altogether too cephalic and disembodied. But other than that, it's okay. Now, here's what I mean by that. It's too material. I've already alluded to that. We are very consumed with the idea of the brain as 3 pounds that's kind of like a bag of chemicals. The emphasis in the last 50 years in clinical practice, in neurology, and largely in psychiatry, outside of those of us who are champions of psychotherapy, has been that brain problems involve absence generally of certain chemicals, maybe some excesses of certain chemicals, and that the brain wiring is generally seen to be fixed, and the system is failing, and what we do with our chemicals, our drugs, is prop up a failing system. Now, I just want to say that about a third of my patients are on medication. This is not some tract against medication. This is an attempt to analyze how we approach things very generally. So there is a role for medication, and thank God for some of the medications we have. I'm just saying that at times they're overused, and we can actually do things. We can also sometimes do better. So the material view of the brain and the chemical view of the brain go hand in hand. Now, the sort of premise of the chemical view of the brain is the following, that chemicals are used for signaling purposes in the brain. The chemicals you hear about, serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, are all used as signaling. And so they kind of speak a language of the brain. And when you listen to drug company commercials, you hear things like, depression is a chemical imbalance. Now, is there something about some truth to that? Yeah, a little bit. But that is a really impoverished account of the complexity of depression that doesn't begin to exhaust all we know about depression. I mean, we know that if you break up with someone, you get ups, you can, or two in a row, you can get depressed. You know, we know that if you stick an electrode in the brain of a human being who's been depressed, non-responsive to medication, if you stick it in an area called C25, a switch is thrown and a person can come out of depression sometimes, the work of Helen Mayberg. So the idea that the brain speaks a kind of chemical language really has to be revised. The chemical language usually occurs extremely locally in the brain between various branches of neurons. And the chemicals we hear about so often, like dopamine, for instance, I mean, it's not used indiscriminately throughout the brain. It's used in certain key areas that affect Parkinson's, that affect reward. It's used in one hemisphere more than another. So as I conceive of it, the chemical language of the brain is like a series of dialects because they're local. But there is another language of the brain, and that is the lingua franca of the brain. That is the language that's spoken throughout the brain by every single neuron in the brain. And that is the language of patterns of electrical energy. Now, our view of the brain, I believe, is too digital. Anyone who's taken a Bio 101 course, and probably a high school course, learns that neurons are either on or off. That's actually not quite right. The only time your neurons are completely off is when they are dead. When they are not dead, they either fire typically very slowly, you know, occasional spikes, or the spikes speed up for the so-called on position. In some parts of the brain, that's reversed, but that's the typical thing. So thinking about this and doing a lot of quantitative, just reading the literature on quantitative EEGs, which comes out of neurofeedback, and studies of the brain in general, I've put together the following scheme as to what I think actually happens in the brain. Before I tell you that, let me tell you what I think most people think happens in the brain. Because they have the digital view of the brain, if a person has a stroke and they lose 90% of the use, let's say, of their left hand, the assumption has been that neurons are either on or off, and if you can't get it on, the assumption has been that 90% of the neurons that govern the movement of that hand are dead, or the tracks coming from those neurons are damaged. That's consistent with that view, but that view is wrong. What I think happens is the following. Some neurons die. They send off no signals. Neurons adjacent to those dead neurons are now suddenly not getting any input. And it will take a while for them to adapt to the total absence of input. And so they are not going to function well during that period. Some neurons are sick. They survived whatever the stroke or the assault of the illness. And so they're firing, but they're sick neurons and they're not firing at the correct speed. And we know that in many cases of brain injury, for instance, our brain fires what are called delta waves, which are very, very slow waves. And probably that interferes with functioning of those areas because it's literally like the brain in that area is asleep. Now, what about the recipients of the signals from the sick neurons? They could be healthy, but they're getting faulty input. So they're not functioning optimally. And then there are, for sure, some neurons that are unaffected by this whole process, that are healthy and functioning well. So we now have a situation where there are far fewer dead neurons than anticipated, but a lot of the signaling that's going on in the brain is what I call the noisy brain. It's out of sync. It's offbeat. It's too slow. It's too fast. In a way, we were thinking that the brain, when it's damaged, is like a heart in a heart attack where something's dead. But what I'm saying is it's often like a heart that's having an arrhythmia. And this opens the possibility that we can resynchronize these circuits to improve function radically. And that's what I think a lot of these treatments that I'm going to describe do. Now, That explains the problem with the digital brain. I also believe we have an imperial view of the brain, which is wrong. Here's what I mean by that. In the 19th century and the 20th century, the great triumph of neurology and neuroscience has been to map the brain, to discover where in the brain bodily processes tend to occur. So we now know that if a person has a stroke and can't move, let's say, her right leg, that her problem may not be in her right leg, as she thinks it to be, but in the part of the brain that processes movement in the right leg. And there have been, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of such discoveries. And with brain scans, we've done more and more mapping of the brain. And so, in a way, this has been the great triumph. But unfortunately, there's an occupational hazard to spending your entire time mapping the brain. You start to feel that the brain is where all the action is. And so you get people writing books with titles, and I know they mean well, and I am not scoffing at it, I'm just pointing out a phenomenon, but, you know, with titles like You Are Your Brain. Or I once hosted a movie, and it began with a neurosurgeon holding a brain and said, this is your brain. In here, in your neurons, are all your desires and fears and hopes and blah, blah, blah. This is the essence of you. Now, in this view, which reaches its apotheosis in artificial intelligence, which uses computer models, or sometimes called computationalism, to try to analyze brain circuitry. The brain is where all the action is, and the body is seen as mere infrastructure for the brain. If the brain controls everything, then the body is merely the subject receiving commands from the master. Now, there's something terribly, terribly wrong with this, because bodies did not evolve to serve brains. Historically, brains evolved long after bodies did to serve bodies. If you look at the history of all life, you know, the period of time from the first chemicals that are inanimate to the birth of the cell is like this long. Then the period of time from the birth of the single-celled organism to the multi-celled organism is like this long. And the birth from the multi-celled organism to an organism that has a brain is about this long. Brains are latecomers. And what happened is that as brains evolved, bodies changed to accommodate brains. And as bodies changed, brains evolved and so on. It's really only in anatomy textbooks that brains are separate from bodies. You know, in real life, in terms of function, they're inseparable. It's not as though we developed a body as a module and then a peripheral nervous system as a module and a brain as a module, and they didn't co-evolve with each other. The brain seamlessly relates to the body through the peripheral nervous system and relates to the senses, through the senses to the outside world. And the outside world impacts the senses with patterns of energy. That's how it works. Now, the view has also been too cortical. Too cortical means that the early experiments on the brain involved access to the outside of the brain, usually with microelectrodes, and we learned a tremendous amount from those experiments. But it has been harder, and only in the last 30 or so years that we've been able to look at the living brain's activity deep inside the brain and this what's called the subcortical brain. And so we've made many errors in trying to explain some of our brain problems. And the biggest one that comes to – the first one that comes to mind is the question of ADD, where, you know, people are told that people with ADD have frontal lobe and by which they mean frontal cortex problems. And so we invent treatments that are targeted to what we think are frontal lobe functions. But in fact, if you look at the circuitry with our new brain scan studies, you see that people with ADD also have subcortical problems. And it opens, and the subcortex is very, very close, for instance, closer to the ears and closer to some of the nerves of the face closer to some of the sense receptors. So we've had a very cephalic and disembodied view of the brain. We've tended to think that to fix brain problems, we must go directly to the brain, and we can ignore the body. And so when people come along and they're body workers and they change a person's state of their nervous system in 2 seconds, we think of that as kind of mushy stuff. And in this book, I show that various techniques, including the Feldenkrais technique, which is known to most people as something for aching backs and necks, can actually do profound work on strokes or children missing parts of their brains. You can talk to the brain through the body. And this is not flaky. This is natural. This is the way it works. Now, I would say that the work in this book came out of a number of epiphanies. Some of them I've already alluded to. But what I want to do is just line them up right together so you can see what I think is the essence of the breakthrough. These were the times when I was I was putting together what I was learning and realized, my God, there is a different model that we can have. So I'm going to describe things that everybody knows. You probably learned a lot of it in high school, but I just learned to look at them differently. The first thing is this. We see beautiful images. We smell fragrant odors. We hear sounds that move us emotionally. But there are no images in our brain. There are no fragrant odors in our brain. There's no moving sounds in our brain. They may be in our mind, whatever that means. In our brain, there are patterns of energy. Number one. Number two. Our senses, to use an engineering term, are transducers. A transducer is a device or some processors in a living thing that convert one form of energy to another, or the patterns of information in one form of energy into patterns of information in another form of energy. So this microphone, this brain has got electrical energy, which is converted but into vibrations of my vocal cords, which goes into, that's a transduction, which goes into this microphone, which converts sound energy into electrical energy, which then goes into the loudspeaker, which is another transducer, which converts electrical energy into sound waves. And many of our senses are transducers. Our eyes convert photons, light energy, into electrical energy. Our ears, sound energy, of course, into electrical energy. Even our olfactory sense, by a very recent theory of how it works, is a transducer in an interesting way. It's thought that the molecules that we smell vibrate, and the receptors in our nose respond to the resonance of those vibrations. So even they appear to be transducers along these lines. And the third thing is that you now all know is that the brain is plastic. So putting all these things together, we can, if we know what we are doing, take frequencies of energy or in particular patterns, feed them into our senses or through our bodies when we move them, into our which converts them into electrical patterns, which then change the structure and function of our own electrical circuits. Now the question becomes, is this a trivial thing? Or can we actually use these techniques to deal with some of the most challenging neurological conditions that exist? We can't deal with them all, but I will tell you that one patient after another in this book had been told they would never get better. And this included patients with stroke, Parkinson's, MS, brain injury, autism, learning disorders, sensory processing disorders, the aging brain, and many kinds of chronic pain, just to mention a few. These conditions all had what I call aspects of the noisy brain in one way or another. Okay. So that's the introduction. Now I want to start off, move into the films to try to show you an example of someone undergoing some brain change and tell you a couple of stories of brain change. Now, you may think that these are mere anecdotes that don't apply to most people because all the people in these stories are green. But they were not always green. And I'll start off just by telling you the story of Dr. Paul Bachirida, who's in the first book and whose work extends into the second book. Because I've spent a lot of time thinking about one case in the first book, the case of Cheryl. I learned a tremendous amount, again, of just pouring over in my head what happened to this woman. So Paul Bachirida was born into a very pretty intellectual family. His father, Pedro, was a Catalan poet, and he taught literature. And Paul was a real reader. He was a very sickly child, was beat up every day he went to school, very, very short because of his illness, and retreated into the library and ultimately wanted to become a scientist, but for very practical reasons became a physician and tried to go back and forth in the course of his career between basic research and medicine. Now, when Pedro was 68 years old, he had a devastating stroke. He was paralyzed on one side of his body, and he couldn't speak. And he had 6 weeks in the hospital, a very light rehab, which was typical at the time. And the reason they did that was because it had been learned 100 years before that during a stroke, the brain goes through a period of basically what you might call brain shock. Even if the stroke was in a small part of the brain is busy basically getting rid of extra blood, clots, and so on, dealing with the inflammatory tissue, the chemical chaos that ensues after some kind of injury. And so they would wait till that crisis called diakysis passed, and believing that the brain, of course, was fixed and that you could never grow new brain cells or new connections, they would see what was left. And the purpose of rehabilitation was to prime the pump, just to see what was left. It wasn't to grow new connections in the brain. And so at the end of the 6 weeks, and this diakysis can last 6 weeks, 2 months, maybe even as long as 6 months in some people, they tried to prime the pump, and there was nothing. He was completely paralyzed on one side. So the doctor called Paul's brother in, his name was George, and said, you know, you've got to take your father to a chronic care facility. And George, knowing his father, was a very vigorous man who really loved life. And he calculated that his father would die in that facility, in that situation of limited stimulation. And George was a medical student, but just in his first year. And he just put his father in the car. And Pedro was 5 feet tall. He lay him out in the back of the car. And he drove him all the way to Mexico, where he was studying medicine. And he got his fellow medical students to take his father out of the car. And then he said the following. He winged it. He said, Papa, you learned to walk by first learning to crawl. So let's try to support you and get you to crawl again. And so the medical students held him. And when, after a period of intensive exercise, the kind of attention that only a loving, caring family member might be willing to give, perhaps, or a very close friend, he actually could crawl. Then they got the outside of the villa wall. They put him near the outside of the villa wall, and he was to support one of his limbs on the wall while he was crawling. Then they got him standing and supporting, and eventually they got him walking, and then they taught him to type incrementally, raising the arm slowly from the shoulder over a period of 2 years, by the way, then from the elbow, then from the wrist, and then from the fingers. And they got him typing, and using incremental practice, they got him speaking. Now, I imagine that in times past, loving family members did do this. But in the era where there was this doctrine of the unchanging brain, and all the scientists and clinicians believed this was impossible, no one would be encouraged to undertake this arduous, incremental kind of exercise. And although George was a medical student, he was only in the first year, and he hadn't learned that the brain is not plastic, because that precious knowledge was kept for more senior students. And so he undertook this. And when Pedro was 75, he had remarried, he was teaching, he was writing poetry, and he went mountain climbing in Bogota, Colombia, with friends. And there in the thin mountain air, he had a heart attack, alas, and he passed away. And at this point, Paul Bachirrida decided to have the body flown back to San Francisco, where he was working as a physician. And he ordered an autopsy. They didn't have many brain scans or other ways to deal with, to learn about the brain in those days. And a couple days later, he was pulled down to the pathology lab, and there spread out in front of him were slices of his father's brain. And Paul had all the feelings you might anticipate a person would have in this highly unusual, macabre, weirdly intimate, yet clinical situation. And yet, as he looked over those slides, he saw something that changed his life. He saw that when he looked at the brainstem area, that the pathways coming from the motor cortex, leading down ultimately to the spinal cord and muscles, that convey the messages from the brain to govern movement, were 97% obliterated. And that meant to him that the work that his brother George had done with his father must have somehow rewired his father's brain. Somehow other pathways, other neurons, were allowing this movement to occur. And so he became a champion of what he called late brain plasticity, the idea that the brain is plastic from cradle to grave. Because he was also the world's leading researcher in the muscles that move the eye, something which is very, very important in the chapter I have on blindness in my new book, he wondered if the senses were plastic as well. The sensory part of the brain was plastic. And I'm skipping ahead because this is covered in the first book. But basically, in 1969, in Nature, the premier scientific journal in Europe, there appeared a picture of a bizarre-looking dentist chair. And on the back of it was a plate of about 100 or so vibrators. And then there were thick cords that led to an IBM computer, 1969 style, you know, like Alvin Turing style size. And then there was a big, thick series of cords that led to a 1960s television camera, like this big. Do you remember those? And what the article said was that people, a number of people, who had been blind since birth, they'd never seen anything, which is always an interesting philosophical problem, would sit in this chair. They'd move the camera around, and the image would be converted into little dots, like dots on your computer screen, by the computer, and fed into the vibrating back, and paint a kind of picture on their back, because sometimes they would move for dark and stay still for light, or the reverse, I can't remember which. And these people reported, after a little bit of training, the following kinds of things: that they could make out objects. If you threw a paper airplane at the camera, they would duck. If you put the vibrating plate on their tummy and threw the paper airplane at the camera, after a little bit of training, they would duck. They could tell who was coming in and out of the room. If you showed them a magazine picture, they could make out Twiggy versus another model. So they could detect looming objects, perspective, outline. And this was all coming in through their back, which was chosen because Bachirida analyzed the capacity of the skin to get information and compared it to the retina. And he thought there was sufficient sensitivity in the skin's receptors in their distribution that you could get enough information for an image. Now, shortly after my first visit, in-depth visit to the lab, I found out that a number of people were coming to the lab who had balance problems. Cheryl's balance problem was a unique balance problem. She didn't have any other problems. But as the lab understood that it could help balance, they wondered, well, could it help people who had balance problems with Parkinson's or MS or traumatic brain injury? You know, if you go to medical school, you study very hard to differentiate these kinds of illnesses. But as I've sort of stood back from them, I'm struck that in these brain problems, you know, they often have very similar issues. They often have balance problems, movement coordination problems, problems dealing with sensory input. In some ways, they're very similar. It's important to understand how they're different. And the essence of Western diagnosis is to focus on the things that seem different. That's how we're trained, because we believe deep down they have different causes. But another point of view might be, if you're treating some symptoms — there's nothing wrong, by the way, in treating symptoms in certain cases — maybe the fact this is meaningful, that they all have similar problems. So anyway, someone would come for a balance problem from Parkinson's. They'd go on the device, their balance would get better, and then they would look like Cheryl when she was in that sort of meditative state, and their tremor would go away. Or someone would come with a brain injury, and they were very hypersensitive and had lost the ability to see in 3D, and that would change. And someone would come with MS, as I describe in the book, who had lost his voice, so it was staccato. And within a few sessions, this man, who was formerly a famous Broadway singer, within five days, was belting out Old Man River. So Yuri, basically, the Russian guy there, who was raised in Siberia, and by the way, had had a lot of exposure to traditional Chinese medicine growing up, but was a major neuroscientist in Russia. And, you know, he'd studied biology, he'd studied engineering, he'd studied biophysics. As a young man, he would do things like being intrigued by acupuncture. He'd sort of wire up little machines to try to find acupuncture spots on the skin by whether the conductance of the electricity changed. So he had the following really heretical thought. Cheryl got better because, as they had initially thought, because she was getting information on the tongue that told her where she was in space. The way the device was designed is, if you leaned forward, the sort of electrical stimulation, which felt like champagne bubbles popping on the tongue, would swirl forward. If you leaned to the side, she'd get the information that it was swirling to the side. Okay, that made a lot of sense as the mechanism of action as to how someone would improve balance. But why would that get rid of a tremor in Parkinson's? Why would that allow someone with MS to improve their voice? And the heretical thought was, maybe it wasn't just the information on the electrical stimulation. Maybe it was the actual electrical stimulation that was working. That they were putting a lot of stimulation. Again, they weren't shocking the brain, but just turning on a lot of cells so that the brain was booting up with lots of stimulation. And that was somehow resetting the brainstem. And he knew from his experience in Russia that, in fact, there were these Russian sleep machines, as they were called. So they didn't have big pharma in Russia. And when people couldn't sleep, they had, again, I think it was the influence of Eastern medicine and the beginnings of, you know, acupuncture led to electroacupuncture, and they modified something called the TENS machine, etc. They would help people sleep by putting very mild stimulation on the forehead. They could also alert people by changing the wave pattern. So perhaps the frequency of these wave patterns was leading to a huge reset. And so they designed a new device with a new patent, which didn't have, you know, waves of champagne bubbles moving around. And they perfected that device. And the theory was, and I elaborate this in my book, that, again, when circuitry is damaged or noisy, it doesn't just generate noisy signals. You try to do things with that noisy brain, you can't, and then you learn you can't, and so you stop trying to do those things, and the circuitry in the use-it-or-lose-it brain goes dormant. So they started using these things for a variety of conditions. So, for instance, one woman, Jerry Lake, from Champaign, Illinois, an extremely vigorous, robust athlete, who was also a nurse practitioner and the head of a group of nurses at a hospital and used to go on 500-mile bike rides, was riding to work in February, and a car did something it shouldn't have done at an intersection, and she slammed on the brakes, flipped over, hit her head, broke her helmet on the right side, and basically developed a traumatic brain injury. So she could no longer concentrate on anything. She would lie in bed all day long, get up and do something for half an hour and be exhausted. She lost the ability to see 3D vision, so everything looked flat. She had double vision. If she heard the forks and knives touching on the table, it was overwhelming to her. And, she, you know, because she was hypersensitive to sound, she could barely walk. And when she came, and so she got neuropsychological evaluation, etc., they basically said, you know, the recovery you make will happen in the first year. Come back to me in a year. We'll see where you are. And they came back. Oh, and I neglected to say she lost the ability to recognize any differences between any human faces. So that when her granddaughter was born, if she saw her a second time, she wouldn't recognize her. And this was very, very painful. And she was completely disabled at the end of a year. And she was told this condition is permanent. You will not be going back to work for sure as a nurse practitioner, and maybe not at anything else. And 5 years passed, and she was unable to do anything else. She had some conventional rehabilitation and made very modest improvement. The day she came into the lab, this formerly robust athlete, you know, could barely walk. If she had no balance, if she had to turn her head to look, you know, to her side to see something or look up, she would fall over. Her gait was tested. She had to walk along a hall and then in a dynamic gait index test, step over a shoebox, and she could barely manage that. They put her in what they call the shaking phone booth to see if she could stand up, and she did terribly. And she was just sobbing, telling her story, certain the team would reject her. And then she put the device in her mouth, and the team filmed all of this. And something special seems to happen at the 13 to 17 minute mark. And at first, and early on, they said, okay, now we want you to close your eyes, which frightened her terribly because she had no balance. But they timed it so that she could manage it. And then at the end of it, she's shocked when they say the time is over, because you saw, Cheryl, they go into some kind of state. And they turn it off, and she looks up, and then she looks over at her husband, which normally she wouldn't do because she'd fall over, and she realizes she's not fallen over, and then she walks perfectly normally, and she's unbelievably delighted but afraid, as most people are in this case, to believe it because it seems like it's a dream. And then she does more trainings. Some of them are meditative trainings to calm the nervous system. Others are trainings of moving while you're using the device. She goes to sleep. She wakes up the next morning. She looks out the window, and she's stunned. She sees there are trees, and behind them there's space and more trees and space and more trees. I have three-dimensional vision again. And she's completely blown away. And by the end of the week, she is running up and down the hills outside the lab at Madison, Wisconsin. And she can recognize, some weeks go by, she can now recognize human faces. So they would test it neuropsychologically. They'd show her a bunch of faces, and a lot of them would be repetitions, and they would say, have you seen this one before? And she would never get it. So that's just one example. And that is basically an energy-based information talking the language of the brain to the circuitry of the brain. Now, I'll give you another couple of examples, and then we'll take questions. I could go on and talk about light and movement, but I want to talk a little bit about sound. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Please understand, I have to simplify and outline just a couple of mechanisms by which things are working. I can't possibly talk about all the mechanisms in a short talk, but just to give you a sense of how people talk to the brain. So one of the most exciting developments that's happening right now is that there is a new view of autism. And in some respects, I think it's actually come from the parents of autistic children. Western medicine divides care up, and we send, if you have a heart problem, you go to a heart specialist, a cardiologist, and if you have a kidney problem, a nephrologist, and an emotional problem, a psychiatrist, etc. So autistic children would come to psychiatrists because it's been defined as a psychiatric condition and they have behavioral issues and so on. And then the parents would notice that they had gastrointestinal problems galore, more than is common. So they would take the child to the gastroenterologist, and they would often have dermatitis and skin problems, and they take the child to the, and you might talk to the psychiatrist about it, and they might say, well, go ahead, that's not my department, but by all means. But so many of these kids had so many problems that it's now pretty clear, and it's beautifully articulated by the Harvard pediatric neurologist, Martha Herbert, that autism is really a whole body disease that affects the brain. It's not a brain disease that occasionally goes with body problems. And there are tons of signs of inflammation throughout the body of many of these children. And in their brains, on autopsy, they have signs of gross inflammation. They have high levels of antibiotics. And as we've been able to do various kinds of sophisticated brain scans, we being the royal we of science, we find their brains are underconnected in many areas. They're underconnected, for instance, between the auditory cortex and the reward center of the brain that gives you what I call pleasure of speech. And we know the following things about many autistic children. They have hypersensitivities to sound. They're often covering their ears. They can drive the sounds can drive them berserk, particularly low machine sounds. Now, why is this happening? It was Dr. Alfred Tomatis, the French otolaryngologist, who basically discovered that the ear has something he called the auditory zoom. Just as your camera has a zoom lens and you can you can focus on certain things and not other things if you want, so does the ear have its own kind of zoom. So that if you walk into a party, there's booming, buzzing confusion, and then yet, as time elapses, you start to make out human speech and a conversation about religion here and politics here and romance here, and then you decide which you want to avoid and you go towards it, the others, right? And that's your auditory zoom working. And one of the things that happens in a lot of children with developmental problems, special needs, delays, is they're hypotonic, they have slack muscles, but they have problems with the auditory zoom too. This is not all there is to helping autistic children. And I'm just giving you a window as to how frequencies can be helpful. There's way more to it, I know. So one of the interventions that Tomatis invented was taking music, and sometimes he would take the mother's voice, and he would modify the frequencies to train that circuitry so that He did it very incrementally to help these children begin to develop an auditory zoom, and he also gave them frequencies that grounded them. This is a simplification, but over time, they would stop having these hypersensitivities to sound. And sometimes it would happen amazingly rapidly. I have a case in the book where this was applied in Toronto, where within the first couple of days, this autistic boy who was probably severe or moderate severe, hadn't had a normal night's sleep for years. He developed an autistic regression at 18 months. His speech deteriorated. Eye contact stopped. Started treating his parents like things and so on. A couple of days into it, he's different, the grandmother says. And he begins to establish eye contact with his mother. The next day, he hugs his father for the first time spontaneously in his life. And this boy, was, you know, the doctor said would be institutionalized, went on to, over a period of years, he would get several weeks a year and he would get boosters to no longer need educational assistance, EAs they're called in Canada, and eventually functioning on his own, and then eventually gets in we have grade 12 here in Canada. He gets an A in English. This is a guy who had no speech, has friends, and he's on track to go to university. And he still has mild autism. He has a lot of quirky interests that autistic children do. But what his mother said was the most painful part for her. At the beginning of treatment, is she had lost her relationship with her son. She wanted the relationship back. And they got that back, and they got it back quickly. I have another case of a boy. I'm not saying that the following case is typical. The first case is more typical, where he was to be institutionalized. He was kicked out of school for biting. He was smashing his head against the wall. He'd had an autistic regression at 18 months. And he ended up graduating in school with honors, went to university, did a degree in – his name is Jordan Rosen. He wants people to know what happened to him. He did a degree in management, which requires people skills. He has people skills. He loves his friends. He loves parties. He totally values his parents. He's bright. He's witty. Totally connected kid. I'm not saying this happens most of the time, but this was clearly, he was clearly hugely affected by this intervention. I interviewed people here in Denver who did ILS, Integrated Listening Systems, which is a system that involves sound therapy and movement therapy and vision therapy. Maybe some of you have heard of it, and it's often used at the Star Clinic here. And I met with a woman who had basically had no response after a terrible truck accident, where a truck landed kind of on her car. And she was just basically non-functioning and disabled for many years. And she did the treatment and is now functioning. She went back to school, completed university. I mean, she couldn't read. She couldn't do anything. She was non-functional. Another little girl, perhaps the youngest person on the planet ever to see receive this kind of neuroplastic intervention, was, as an infant, unable to eat. And the doctors thought she had reflux. And they did all sorts of interventions. But in fact, the diagnosis was sensory processing disorder. So this is a disorder which is hugely under-recognized and under-diagnosed. And if you think about it, if you can't integrate sensations, if they seem too intense or chaotic because you can't integrate touch and sound, imagine what it's like to swallow food, take stuff that you taste from another human being, from the breast, that moves into your body, that, you know, causes gas. It's overwhelming for a child. And these children are often worked up and they have tubes stuck down them. Well, gosh, imagine if you had a sensory processing disorder and you're hypersensitive to everything. And the doctors, with the best of intentions, which actually makes it worse, are sticking tubes down you to try to figure out if you've got reflux and so on. It's like torture. And I mean, it's unbelievable torture. Anyway, the mother basically was, you know, searching the internet. She thought it was sensory processing. She went to the Star Clinic. They hooked her up with an ILS prototype. She did the treatment. She was now calm for the very first time. This was the neuromodulation stage, I believe, that happens after the proper neurostimulation. She started to sleep properly. That's the neurorelaxation phase I describe. And then I think she was available for learning. That's to use a kind of Feldenkrais term, and differentiation. And now she's pretty much, forgive the use of this word, but, you know, a normal, very happy, engaged kid. So I've just gone over a few of the problems that can be helped. It's okay. I mean, I wish everybody was helped all the time, but it's okay if we have something new and it doesn't help everybody all the time if it's progress. And these cases are all real. You know, halfway through writing this book, which was a very painful process for me in many respects, my editor actually had a stroke. And he very bravely completed the book. He was paralyzed on one side, doing some of the things in this book and in the first book. And at the end of the book, thank God, he took his first steps. So we can't help everybody all the time, but when we help somebody, it's a major event. And yet this book is called Recoveries and Discoveries. It's about understanding a new model of the brain, a model where we try to speak the brain's own language. That won't help a person who's burst a blood vessel. I get that. But it can help a lot of things that we thought were beyond help. And so when I was trying to come up with a title for the book that would be truthful, that I would have to live with, I thought, is it fair to call what I'm describing healing? Because people didn't talk about the brain and healing. And I went, as I often do, to the roots etymologically of the word I was about to use. And the root of healing is the old English halen. And it means not only cure, but to make whole again. And I satisfied myself that many of these people said to me over and over, I got my life back. And so I think that they were healed.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.